This man's job has brought him lawsuits and death threats.
I don't chop down trees to send paper through the mail. I pay for my own resources. You know, I don't see where we're doing anything wrong. And if there was something wrong, why aren't there any federal laws pertaining to it?
That's Alan Ralsky. He's a bulk emailer, and he may be filling your inbox with advertising for vacation destinations, diets, plasma TVs. It's the cyberspace equivalent of junk mail, reviled the world over as spam, strictly defined as unsolicited commercial email.
We'll hear more from Alan Ralsky in a moment, but to better understand why business and consumers spend billions of dollars a year in lost productivity and in software to fight spam, we first called Jason Catlett of Junkbusters Corporation, a privacy advocacy group.
The mechanisms for sending spam are exactly the same as for sending legitimate email newsletters, for example. The big difference is whether the person who receives it wanted it or asked for it.
Now, I've heard that all you need is a few CDs with, you know, millions of email addresses on them, a list of foreign internet service providers to relay messages, and a spamware mailing program which has some cloaking features. That would cost something about $2,000, and you can sort of set yourself up as a large spammer.
It's depressingly easy for spammers to get started, and it requires very little intelligence or money. In fact, much of the spam you get is for email lists, for spamming software that promise for as little as $19.95, you can be annoying millions of people around the world from the comfort of your own home.
If people are getting CDs with, you know, thousands of these email addresses, where are they getting them? How are they setting these things up? Where are these things available?
There are two ways that spammers get email addresses. The first one is called favorably harvesting, and more accurately, I think, scavenging. They get a piece of software to go around looking at web pages and extracting anything that looks like an email address. Then they simply check that against the email address with the ISP the mail protocol allows, and then it's simply added to a list. More recently, spammers have been using a more sophisticated technique called dictionary spamming, which is basically sophisticated guesswork. If they see an address like john42@aol.com, then they try john43@aol.com, and John, if that exists, they then try john44@aol.com. So by a process of systematic exploration and guessing, they can actually get email addresses that were never published anywhere, and of course this drives people insane.
Why is this called spam?
The most common explanation comes from a Monty Python sketch in which a couple ordering food in a restaurant were drowned out by some Vikings inexplicably singing the words spam, 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 spam.
I remember
spam,
this.
Spam, spam, spam,
spam. I remember. I
Lovely
do remember
spam,
this.
Wonderful it's, spam.
I do
spam.
Remember this was a great song.
it's very catchy, and I think presciently people realized this junk has the potential to flood out all legitimate and routine communications, and that's the terrifying thing about spam.
Now, the rumor that we've all heard, and I'd love to know if this is true, is that if you type remove, it just makes it worse.
Actually, if you type remove, it's almost certain that nothing will happen, apart from possibly you getting an email back from an ISP saying, we've never heard of H49264 bonus offers at whatever the address was.
Yeah, I get that all the time. Now, how come?
Spammers want to spamouflage their identity. They cover it up by putting a fake header or a dummy return address.
I have a real problem. I have received in the last 18 hours since I knew I was going to be talking to you, I decided not to erase anything, and I have 10 different spam emails in this one 18-hour period, and 9 of them are Korean. And they are in Korean language as well. I don't even know, you know, there are pictures selling everything from sex to cell phones and so forth, but they're Korean email. Where do these come from?
Unfortunately, other countries have learnt from the United States, which was the biggest and first originator of spam, and now we're paying for it. It's ludicrous that all of these junk messages are being sent across the Pacific Ocean. 2 days ago, I got a spam from a man in Lima who wanted to sell his Toyota, and it's totally implausible that I, here on the Eastern Seaboard, would want to buy a Toyota in Lima, Peru. But the economics of spamming mean that it's just as easy for him to send to a huge list and hope that some of those people are living in Peru and might actually want to buy the Toyota.
Thank you, Jason, for joining us.
It's been a pleasure, Margot.
Jason Catlett, president of Junkbusters Corporation in New Jersey. Alan Ralsky sends out more than 30 million commercial emails a day from a Detroit suburb. He does not consider himself a spammer.
I think that a spammer has no regard of where his mail goes and to whom. And if the person, and then what I do as a commercial emailer is that we'll take your email address off our list if you want to be deleted.
Now, I've heard that the FTC doesn't buy that argument.
That's not true, as far as I'm concerned.
And let me ask you, for every, oh, I don't know, for every 100,000 that you send out, how many people respond?
You're going to get 0.5% as a bare bones minimum.
And do you use what they describe as blind relays? In other words, sending the messages to, let's say, Asian countries, and then they get redirected back?
I won't make a comment on that.
I gather that ever since it's been known that this is your business, that people have been talking about you on the internet. I gather you've even gotten death threats.
Yeah, I have.
Well, give me some examples.
Well, they'll say, we're going to come by and stomp you out.
How many death threats have you gotten?
Maybe one or two a week, and then it tails off, and then it picks up.
You know, there are some organizations that want to publish your home and family information, I gather, some anti-spam organizations.
They do it. They're on the net. It's out there. My feeling when I started this business is that I can put an average company, small company, a company with very little assets on the same playing field as a Fortune 500 company. So my feeling is that this is free enterprise.
So you're seeing this as helping the economy.
It does. It definitely does.
Alan Ralsky, director of Creative Marketing Zone in West Bloomfield, Michigan.
There is software available to filter spam, but it's not without flaws. So for years, opponents have been urging a spam ban. That's resulted in a slew of state laws against unsolicited email and a number of lawsuits. But that still hasn't done much to solve the problem. NPR's Larry Abramson explains why.
Some opponents of spam have long said laws will be the answer, and they have history on their side. Attorney David Kramer says that a federal law pretty much shut down another form of unwanted solicitation.
You may recall back in 1991, we had a junk fax problem in this country. You'd come into the office in the morning, and your floor would be littered with junk faxes. A law was passed to prohibit the transmission of unsolicited faxes. And in short order, junk faxes reduced to a manageable problem.
Despite several attempts, Congress has never passed a national law against spam. Instead, the states have taken up the cause. 25 states now have laws that are supposed to restrict the sending of unsolicited messages. Washington State led the pack in 1998 with a measure that bans unsolicited emails or any messages with fake return addresses. Laura Atkins of the anti-spam group SpamCon says that law gives consumers a lot of control.
They put the burden of responsibility on the sender to look at whether or not they're sending mail to a Washington State resident. And Washington State does maintain a list of addresses and domains which are used by Washington State residents. And so as an email sender, the law requires you to query that list.
And Washington State residents who do get unwanted junk emails don't have to wait for the state attorney general to act. The law allows individuals to sue spammers. Bennett Hazelton has gone to court several times. Hazelton is a well-known internet activist who's put his online detective skills to work to find out who's sending him unwanted emails.
sometimes you have to use tricks like giving them fake contact information to say you're interested, and then when you get a follow-up phone call, you just try to wheedle as much information out of them as you can about who they are and where they sent the mail from. And oftentimes, if they think you're an interested customer, they'll give you information that you need to track them down and file a suit against them.
Anyone with Hazleton's energy and savvy can collect $500 per message. But that's the problem. According to attorney David Kramer, few people want to go to that much trouble.
A recipient of junk email typically will say, hey, it's just not worth my time to take action against the spammer.
Kramer says some spammers will simply pay the fine as a cost of doing business. Others have challenged the constitutionality of state laws on interstate emails. Two state Supreme Courts have said those laws are constitutional. But prosecution still depends on the energies of devoted spam foes or of state attorneys general. That's why attorney David Kramer says internet service providers have looked elsewhere for relief from the email onslaughts they say are overwhelming their systems.
I think I would say you'll get better bang for your buck by implementing technical solutions to the problem until we get some real legislation that gives you the economic incentives you need to prosecute someone.
Local phone company and internet provider Verizon is hoping to get some relief from Alan Ralsky when their case goes to court this fall. But that suit could drag on, so the company is seeking immediate relief from technological solutions. Verizon's Tom Daly says the company uses a software filter that allows small mailings to get through.
So that it doesn't completely block the mail, but what it does do is enables the customer to sort the mail, and bulk mail that may be spam goes off to a different folder so they can look at that separately.
Or internet providers can block mass mailings entirely. Susan Atkins of SpamCon says these blocking strategies are ratcheting up the cost of sending spam.
A year ago, they could send out 5 million messages, and they could be sure that, you know, 4 million of those actually hit people's eyeballs and that they actually make sales on them. Now, instead of having to send out 5 million, they've got to send out 20 or 30 million to reach the same number of eyeballs because they're being blocked so aggressively.
Nevertheless, the marketers who use unsolicited emails say it's the only way to reach huge numbers of people at such a low cost. So they'll keep up with the technological and legal arms race that's allowed the spam business to grow just as quickly as the laws against it. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.